I like making films where I don't know what the final outcome will be, because the making is part of the reason for making films, if that makes sense. It's the excitement, the adventure, you know, and if you're working from a very locked down script, then some of those things disappear.
Director Ben Rivers there. We'll hear more about his new film, The Sky Trembles, shortly. Also ahead, we'll fire up the gramophone in tribute to Florence Foster Jenkins.
She was a huge philanthropist, and people forget this. They do think that, oh, it's just this funny old lady who wanted to be a singer. Actually, Florence genuinely lived for music and music appreciation, and to bring music to a larger audience.
And touching down in Tunisia, we'll find out why the nation's cinematic landscape is undergoing something of a renaissance.
We didn't feel free to make what we want, and now it's different. So there is a lot of more than more films, and the work of distribution and production, it's a real genre.
Plus, after one of the most bizarre weeks in American political history, we'll look back at a film that some blame for the rebirth of the KKK. That is today on The Cinema Show from London on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House, I'm Ben Ryland. Now, I've brought my trusty gramophone along this week because I'd like to play you some music. It's said by some that no one could ever really light up a party quite like Florence Foster Jenkins. Despite lacking all rhythmic ability and possessing a peculiar talent for missing any and all musical notes, her bulletproof self-belief garnered her such a following that she filled Carnegie Hall. Now make no mistake, she was a terrible singer, and almost childlike in her persistence. Let's wind this gramophone up now and I'll play you something. This is Florence Foster Jenkins with Like a Bird. Her singing at its finest suggests the untrammeled swoop of some great bird. That was the description given by one spectator lucky enough to attend a performance by Florence Foster Jenkins. Of course, Meryl Streep brings this legendary oddity to life in her new film out today, alongside Hugh Grant.
I'm so excited! We're going to make a recording.
Bravo! It was wonderful, Bunny.
Can I try another take?
Well, I don't see why. That seemed perfect to me. When I was 16 years old, my father told me that if I didn't give up music, he'd cut me off. Of course, he didn't understand. Music is my life.
Cosme McMoon?
That's me, sir.
Maestro, this is the talented young man I was telling you about.
And let's get started.
Author Darryl W. Bullock has spent years researching her, so we asked him to recite some of his thoughts, which we'll fire up for you now on the trusty old gramophone.
I think what's fascinating for the casual listener is, apart from the fact that she was diabolically awful, is that she seems to have just not cared. There's a what you might call a kind of camp quality to her. There's a kind of, you know, the very kind of cabaret, almost burlesque quality to what people think they know about her life. This kind of brazen, almost, you know, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to sing and I'm going to do it no matter what. And the fact that, you know, she had the wherewithal to be able to fund that, and she could do that. But as you get more into her life, as you discover more about her, you find out an awful lot more. And there's an awful lot, unfortunately, missing in the film. You know, they've had to make something that's short, snappy, funny, and just concentrates on a particular period in life. If you look at her whole life, there's an element of sadness there. You know, she lost a sister in her very early on in her life. She had a difficult relationship with her parents. She had a very difficult relationship with her first husband. But there was always this desperate urge within her to make music, initially as a piano player, and then when she could no longer play piano to concert standard, as a singer. She had this absolute belief in herself that she could perform and would perform, and nobody was going to stand in her way. And I think that's an attractive thing for a lot of people. She was a very, very talented musician. She won awards for musicianship. She did incredibly well at music college, and she performed twice at the White House. You know, she was an incredibly talented young pianist, but it was after she no longer was able to play to concert standard. It's suggested in the film that maybe because she had syphilis and that caused scarring and it caused difficulty with her hands and stuff like that. It's more likely, actually, that there was an accident that she and her family had when she was in her 20s that caused injuries and made her arm less mobile, less flexible, so it proved much more difficult for her to play to concert standard. But you know, she was a musician. She really wanted to be a musician. There was no question in her life that she'd be anything but that. When she was no longer able to play to concert standard, so she couldn't give recitals to the standard that she required or she wanted, she then got involved in promoting music. She formed a club in New York to promote specifically Italian music. That was the Verdi Club. And she raised what today would be millions and millions of pounds for charity. She supported other musicians. She underwrote Toscanini. She supported lots of up-and-coming young players in New York. She was a huge philanthropist, and people forget this. They do think that, oh, it's just this funny old lady who wanted to be a singer. Actually, Florence genuinely lived for music and music appreciation, and to bring music, or certainly the type of music that she was interested in, to a larger audience. People who saw it at Carnegie Hall, and there are a few that's still around, will attest to the fact that it was hysterical, but also that, you know, she was getting on in life. You know, at that point she was in her 70s, she wasn't in the best of health, she wasn't as mobile and as together as she could have been on the night, but she apparently thoroughly enjoyed what she did and what she delivered. And certainly from an audience's point of view, it was raucous, it was funny. You know, they did laugh, they did, you know, the stories of Cole Porter grinding his cane into his foot to stop him laughing, they're true. The story that Tallulah Bankhead was carried out of the audience because she was laughing so much she was in hysterics, it's true. There are certain things that happen in the film which didn't quite happen, but they're just a kind of an exaggeration of what did happen. And it is true that the audience was stuffed full of, you know, servicemen. They're desperate for entertainment in those kind of dark days during World War II. And it was a riot. They absolutely brought the house down.
W. Bullock there on the gramophone. He was speaking to us from his home in Bristol, right here in the United Kingdom. Daryl's book is called Florence Foster Jenkins, The Life of the World's Worst Opera Singer. It's out now, published by Duckworth Overlook. Touching down in Tunisia now, where it seems many recent homegrown films are seeing successes abroad. Bordering Algeria and Libya, and perched upon the Mediterranean, it's a nation rich in history and culture. And a new wave of filmmakers has started tackling the issues, subtly and otherwise, that the country faced both before and after its 2011 revolution. But how is the industry faring within its own borders? Simon Tarek went to the movies in Tunis and discovered a rich world of storytelling that is unprecedented for film audiences nationwide.
Walking out of a cinema in Tunisia today can feel like a dizzying experience, and not just because of the traffic. A record number of films have been made in the country since the 2011 revolution, which effectively opened the country to liberal democracy and opened its film industry to topics never covered before. Because of safety fears, Hollywood and tourists alike are shunning the country, formerly a choice location for big-budget movies. But on the flip side, it seems that its homegrown talent is gaining momentum, making films that mirror the country's intense historical moment. Cinema today is covering a huge range of issues, ranging from corruption to poverty, as well as personal stories too. It's resonating with audiences who for the first time see day-to-day realities reflected back at them. Mohamed Farina, a film distributor and owner of the Cinema Amilcar in Al Manar, Tunis, explains more.
It's the rebirth of theatres now. many Tunisian films this year, and c'est dû à un contexte exceptionnel. First of all, with the production of films, the making of movies. Before, it was very difficult to anyone to get produced to make a movie. It was close to the main power, to the government. So now it has opened, and since 2011, there is a new expression. Artists are expressing themselves more than before. They can do it, and they can do projects. They can find ways to produce themselves, and that's the big change.
The cinematic rebirth hasn't necessarily meant excellent filmmaking straight away. One example is Eclipse, a film made by a titan of Tunisian film and theatre that begins with a police investigation into the sinking of a boat. The story then evolves into a spinning tale of corruption, love, jihadism, and everything in between. Though the narrative is messy, coming across as a hammy crime story more than anything else, it does reveal the rich subject matter filmmakers can now tap into. Another recent film, Hedy, takes a completely different approach. Winner of 2 Golden Bears at this year's Berlin Biennale, it's a thoughtfully shot story of a passive car salesman about to get married to a girl of his mother's choosing. He discovers a new passion for life during a work trip, where he meets a free-spirited woman who dances at a failing hotel. In good films, according to Susan Sontag, there's always a directness that frees us entirely from the itch to interpret. But in Tunisia today, it's difficult to see any movie outside of this current context. Essia Jaiba, a young Tunisian who works for several film festivals and who also worked on the marketing of the film, tells me why Hedy is such a success.
It's a very simple film in the story and in how it was realized. And we feel it, firstly, like a Tunisian, because after a revolution, we have a lot of movies, social movies, which talk about the revolution and how live after that and before that, and very political subjects. And in this film, we have all of this, but it's not the topic of the film. It's we see it, but it's very simple, very natural film, because we talk about one person, one Tunisian, and what he lives in his life, in his simple life, and that's why it's more convincing. We see a new movement with personal stories. We talk about individuals, not the general way to talk about all country and all its problems. We talk about passions, about families, about personal problems and preoccupations. And it helps us to make very pertinent films, very accurate films.
The main change is with the Tunisian movies. They really attract many people to the theaters. Writing and producing, making a movie takes 2, 3, 4 years before we can see it in theaters. We have other movies that are taking big awards in festivals. We had the British Academy Film Award for the film As I Open My Eyes of Leila Bouzid, Horizonti of Venice, and many other big prizes. So it's not just one film, one movie, but it concerns many, many movies. We haven't seen that in theaters. It's the best year, yes, I can say that.
Before the revolution, we have a commission to make films, so it was censored, and we didn't feel free to make what we want, and now it's different. So there is a lot of more films, and this, the work of distribution and production, it's a real job.
The opening up of Tunisian cinema is a welcome sign for a country whose problems, despite its revolution, are far from over. Already, its industry has proven to be a new cultural force to be reckoned with. For Monocle in Tunis, I'm Saima Tariq.
Thanks, Saima. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We'll sit down for a coffee with director Ben Rivers next.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening for you at the moment, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. Now, as MUBI subscribers here in the UK will know, one of the films showing is a dual effort between two very gifted filmmakers named Ben, them being Ben Russell and Ben Rivers. A spell to ward off the darkness follows an unnamed protagonist on a quest for spiritual awakening that takes him from the Arctic to black metal festivals. His latest film is perhaps just as obscure. To use its full title, The Sky Trembles and The Earth is Afraid, and The Two Eyes Are Not Brothers. On the surface, it fits into a snug place next to Rivers' other experimentalist works. But there is a narrative here that sees a filmmaker abandon the set of his film during production in the Sahara. I ventured across town for a coffee with Ben Rivers here in London and asked him how he feels about being labelled an experimental filmmaker.
Maybe they do call me an experimental filmmaker, or there's other monikers as well, I suppose, artist filmmaker. I think it's okay. There's a tendency with that name to think that you're experimenting all the time, like you don't know really what you're doing. And I feel like I do know what I'm doing. But maybe within the way I work, there is a little bit more uncertainty. So I don't have to work from scripts necessarily, even when making a feature. The recent feature was made from like a long treatment. So written more like prose in a way. And there was a shooting script for half of the film, but the other half of the film was shot in a more observational way. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what the final thing is going to be. I like making films where I don't know what the final outcome will be, because the making is part of the reason for making films, if that makes sense. It's the excitement, the adventure. You know, and if you're working from a very locked down script, then some of those things disappear.
Take us back to the earliest time that the film was actually starting to blossom in your head. How do the ideas coalesce?
The film started in two separate projects that kind of came together. One was, I was just in a secondhand bookshop with a friend, and he pulled out this Paul Bowles book and said, "Oh, I think you'll really enjoy this." And I did. And this was about 6-7 years ago. And there was one story in it called A Distant Episode, which really stuck with me. And I read it 2 or 3 times. And I kept thinking that I really wanted to do something with this short story. I wanted to do a kind of adaptation, but not a straightforward adaptation. And it just sort of sat there on the back burner for a while. And then a few years ago, I was thinking about wanting to make a film about filmmaking. So part of this kind of subgenre of films that can take the form of documentaries about films being made, like Burden of Dreams about Herzog's Fitzcarraldo, or Heart of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, or they can be fictions about filmmaking like Le Mépris or Day for Night. There's a bunch of them. And I kind of wanted to do something that was a part of that history. And I'm particularly interested in the apparatus and the process of making films, especially looking at films being made that do it in a different way to the way that I make films, in a way. I like all that apparatus. I like looking at it. I don't necessarily want to make films like that. So I was looking around for different films that I could film, and a good friend of mine, Oliver Lache, said that he was making this feature film in Morocco because he lives there and Morocco is his home, even though he's Spanish. So yeah, he was talking about making this feature film, and I asked him if I could come along and film it, but not as a conventional behind the scenes film. I wanted to be able to have the freedom to film whatever I wanted, including the scenes that he's filming, but from a different angle. And because he was making the film in Morocco, then the Paul Bowles story came back to me, because this was also based in Morocco. And I thought, well, I can put these two things together. And it made complete sense in my mind that the film would start as this observational film about a film being made, but where the lines between reality and fiction of what you're looking at are really blurred. And then at some point in the film, that shifts into a complete fiction, where the film director you've been watching leaves his film set and then becomes the main character in this story, which is very much about a professional outsider who is really seemingly integrated into the country that he's an outsider of, but actually there's a kind of arrogance there, a feeling that he can go anywhere, he can do anything. Yeah, it's a kind of a post-colonial arrogance. And he walks down the wrong path. He goes in the wrong direction just once. And I think in the Bowles story, it's not about retribution. It's not pointing to some kind of comeuppance. It's more just about chance, that chance happens everywhere. And in this case, this chance encounter is the wrong one. It's a bad one. And then we move off into a completely different, darker territory.
Ben Rivers, writer and director of The Sky Trembles, to use its shortened title. That's in limited release now. A right-wing populist is now in charge of America's Republican Party. What everyone thought was impossible is now well and truly within reach. And the old Superman comic books depicting President Lex Luthor suddenly feel slightly less fanciful. Now, the media can have untold effects on the rise and fall of politics. It's been 151 years this week since President Andrew Johnson declared the end of the American Civil War. In 1915, D.W. Griffith released his epic film documenting the struggle, The Birth of a Nation. It's undoubtedly a masterstroke, credited with sparking the entire American film industry and planting the seed in Hollywood's eventual reign. But it also raises some profoundly troubling themes that many believe led to the rebirth of the KKK. But is it still possible to appreciate Griffith's masterpiece through the context of history? Well, here's film critic Tara Judah.
Birth of a Nation is still an important film in terms of its history. It was the incredible box office hit. You know, this film was probably the most profitable film for many years until Gone with the Wind came along. So it really held that box office position. And it was really lauded for its technical advancements. So, you know, this was a really amazing scale. It shows these incredible battle scenes, but it also has a kind of love story and a human element. Of course, it's also an incredibly famous film because of its white supremacist content and for its depiction of Black Americans. And one of the problems there is that also this film had a lot of issues in terms of censorship after it came out. So there was a campaign by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People to try and have this film censored because of the content, because of the historical inaccuracies, because of the presentation of Black people in the film. Some of those Black people are played by Black actors, but there's also a lot of white people in blackface. There's a lot of political issues in the film that, you know, really sort of make it seem as though the Ku Klux Klan were this fantastic group that provided some sort of stability in, you know, post-Civil War, as if the North and the South needed to be kind of brought back together under this sort of like Aryan rule. So it's a really deeply problematic film. But it was a, you know, a kind of a forerunner of kind of blockbuster cinema. It was an incredibly big feature film. It was also the first film to officially play at the White House. Before that, they'd played, I think, Cabiria on the Lawn outside, but this was the first film that was kind of seen in Parliament at the White House. So it has its place in history for those reasons. You know, it's a really important film. But I also think it's a really deeply problematic film and a kind of horrendous film for its terrible content.
It does come across as quite striking that this film has such an important place in cinema history, to look at then some of the themes that are raised in the picture itself. And from my understanding, one of the key reasons for it becoming so successful was that people were well aware of its racist content. I mean, the accusations were, even looking at it through the prism of time, people back then could still look at this and know, you know, this is very racist. But it still encouraged people to go along to the cinema, pay their money, and decide for themselves on what they thought of it. And that was the same for going across the entire country, perhaps except for New York, where it was, of course, censored, as you say. What are your thoughts on whether it actually played a positive part in the creation of cinema simply through its horrendously controversial subject matter?
Yeah, look, I think that it's worth saying that that is important. And as anyone who's interested in film history, it's impossible to completely deny the existence and the relevance and significance of this film and its lasting significance for the way in which we understand motion pictures, filmmaking as a craft, and also, in a sense, also ideology on screen. What I think is problematic is the way in which we often revisit this film. So, you know, it's still on curriculums for film students. It's still a film that receives, you know, restoration money. It's one of those ones that does still get screenings. It gets a lot of attention. And I think it's problematic that this is the film that's lauded. Some of those techniques can be seen in other films. So, you know, we don't necessarily have to use Birth of a Nation as kind of the example of some of the things that D.W. Griffith was doing. Intolerance is a film that came out a year later. And that's also got an interesting kind of starting point, because a lot of that is that people suggest that it was a kind of apology in a way, or a sort of a way to kind of make amends for the fact that there was all this censorship debate around The Birth of a Nation. So Intolerance has that kind of grand epic scale. It also has incredible filmmaking techniques. It shows us different ways in which the filmmaking can be manipulative, particularly with things like, you know, the close-up that he uses and the kind of personal aspect of these political issues. I find Birth of a Nation a really troubling film to kind of revisit, and rewatching it is, you know, a really hard experience, I think, rewatching it today, because the context just seems impossible to get past.
Film critic Tara Judah. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. In The Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith dramatizes the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, a somewhat essential step before his remolding of history can proceed. Storytelling holds immense power. It can actually alter the lens through which we view ourselves and our history. But whether you're in New York in the early 20th century or post-revolution Tunisia, storytelling only works when you get to the truth of something. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yolene Goffin. Catch up over at monocle.com and remember to subscribe to the podcast. The Cinema Show returns next week, where we'll be previewing our upcoming trip to Cannes. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.